And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Back to the bins.
Other side of this microphone is my good buddy, Mr. Scott H. Gardner. That's Scott Human Gardner.
Human.
So, I would say we're gonna do a project now, or we're starting a project now that I've been waiting to do for quite a while. When they announced this series coming out, I wanted to get right on it, and it's been. What was it? It was the end of 2014. So we're talking 10 and a half years that we didn't do it. And then when we finished our Logan's Run project, I thought now's the perfect time to start this. But we didn't. So it's taken forever. But we are going to... Actually, I'm going to even back that up a little bit. We were talking about doing a Planet of the Apes month again, which is still on the table. We still may get there. But in the meanwhile, we are going to cover Star Trek's crossover with Planet of the Apes from 2014. It was started in December of 2014 and it went until April of 2015. And it was a group effort with IDW and Boom Studios. And I remember Scott and I talking about this when it first came out. And again, we've been wanting to do this pretty much since then. So we're going to hit on issue number one today and we'll get through this series. And like I said, a potential Planet of the Apes month is still on the table. Absolutely. I hate to just keep you from speaking here, but I don't think either of us have to give our Planet of the Apes or Star Trek backgrounds, because I think anyone who's listened to us knows how much we love those two properties. I don't even want to say series, because there's just so much to them. So, you know, this was definitely... something where we had to be careful, I think, going in, that it could be a huge disappointment. But, you know, I don't want to spoil everything, but it wasn't. This is a pretty cool series, and I'm looking forward to kind of going through it issue by issue. So now that I've just, you know, taken over the microphone totally, I'm going to hand it over to you for a couple of minutes to give your thoughts, Scott.
Yeah, I was jazzed out of my mind when they announced this, because way back... in the Two True Freaks days, when Chris Honeywell and I were doing, I think we did it as, I forget what banner it was under now, but anyway, we did an Apes, it was either an Apes month or just when we covered the commentary for Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which may have been part of Apes month. I can't quite remember, but where this idea first occurred to me was we were watching Beneath the Planet of the Apes. We were doing our commentary, and it got to the part where there's the fight between Taylor and Brent. And at one point, and I think it was Chris, one of the two of us started like humming the Star Trek fight music, you know, the da 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 da. And we were both like, oh my god, yeah, this is a Kirk fight. This is a total Kirk fight. And that's the first time like, you know, I got my chocolate in my peanut butter, if you know what I mean. You know, the Star Trek and Apes kind of came together in my mind. And I remember us kind of talking a little bit about how cool would that be, you know, a crossover between Star Trek and Planet of the Apes. And I don't remember what year that was, but it, within a relatively short time after that is when this series got announced. And I've always wondered, you know, what are the chances that like the Tiptons just happened to hear that episode and it spurred them or something. I have no idea if there's, you know, any, you know, if that holds any water or what, but I've always been curious about that. And as you say, this has been, you know, something that we've wanted to do for, you know, well over 10 years now. And at one point I had actually reached out to Scott Tipton, the writer on this issue. Actually, I think it's a group effort. I think it's him and his brother are credited as the writers on this. But he and I are friends through Facebook, and I had reached out to him about, you know, coming on the show and, you know, talking about this series. And that was like as the series was coming out, I think, or had just wrapped or something like that. You know, he was perfectly amenable to it and everything, and then it just never happened. And I had considered reaching out to him again for purposes of this, but I just never did, because I think at this point I'd just be embarrassed to be like, sorry, it's been 10 years. But
yeah, I've been busy.
This is bittersweet for me, because I bought this off the stands as it was coming out. I eagerly awaited, you know, every issue of it. The bittersweet part comes in because I'm pretty sure this was just about the last thing I did buy excitedly off the stands before I finally just walked away from New Comics altogether. I've bought very, very little stuff, you know, off the stands, brand new, since this. And I don't think I think everything past this point has been like, I'll grab that. And, you know, but it wasn't like the whole series type of thing. It was like, you know, trying an issue here or there or whatever, but this was one of, if not the very last thing where I bought, you know, the entire series as it was coming out right off the stands before just quitting. And as you say, yeah, it does not disappoint. It's cool. And I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say, it's funny that I have a similar experience as far as buying stuff off the stands. And then the most recent thing that I've bought, which might be the first thing I've bought since this, is that I went out of my way to buy the new issues of Beware the Planet of the Apes came out. Right. So, yeah. You know, it is a property that excites me. That's what it comes down to. And if I hear that it's being done well, I want to be involved in it. Yeah. But there's so few comic properties now that I feel that way about, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
Yeah, especially when you factor in that, you know, there's so much good old stuff to read that I don't really need the new stuff so much.
Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing I've picked up new, just to give a little plug, is our friend from Is It Yours, J.C. Vaughn, his Al Capone vampire series, and, you know, his the other Vampire Pennsylvania and stuff like that. I've bought those and I've enjoyed the heck out of them.
Well, even like, you know, the most recent, not the Beware, I forgot about Beware, but when Marvel first started publishing Apes again, there was that, I think it was a 5-issue series that was taking place in the movie continuity. Mm-hmm.
I think it was just titled Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. Yeah. I got that, but I didn't buy them new off the stands. I actually bought them as back issues, you know, at a cheaper rate. And I don't know, the reason I got this is, I mean, for one, I was just so excited about it, but also it was one of those things like I wanted to get it as it was coming out. And as it turned out, that was a really good call, because I've never seen these in the cheap bins. So, you know, it has maintained its, I don't know if value is the right word, but you know, it's maintained its status to where it didn't immediately become dollar bin fodder, like, you know, 99.9% of new comics coming out these days, which was another reason I got out of buying new comics. You know, You pay, $6 for, issues, only to find them at, every con you'd go to, you'd see them in the 50 cent to a dollar bin, 6 months later. So, but anyway.
It's that particular series that you're mentioning, the other Planet of the Apes one, that's one I didn't actively seek out per se. But when I was seeking out Beware of the Planet of the Apes, I picked up those issues as well.
Have you read it?
I have not yet. I need to.
Yeah, it was good. It was good stuff. So, yeah, I would totally be down for another Apes month. It's just a matter of deciding like what to cover and then finding the time to cover it. Because when we did our original Apes month for that episode or that series of episodes for that month, I literally read every single Apes comic that existed up to that time in preparation for that. And that was an exhausting project, which it was awesome. It was a blast to do, but it was also exhausting. And I just don't have that kind of time in my life right now to do that again.
Sure. I think that if we do an Apes month, what we have to do is we have to find the time to record our regular episodes and then find extra time to do Planet of the Apes episodes in between. And then just keep publishing the regular episodes until we build up a month's worth of Planet of the Apes episodes.
Yep.
So this will, if assuming it happens, and I know we both would like it to, but assuming it happens, it's going to be a long time in the process.
Well, in the meantime, this is 5 issues. So, this is kind of, this could be a Planet of the Apes month of its own, just this series. So, cover
it. Yeah, except we're not going to publish it all in 1 month.
Right.
We're going to do it as we get to it, the same way we did Logan's Run, the same way we did the Thing Hulk battles. So I did the synopsis on this, so I might as well go get right to that. So Star Trek, Planet of the Apes, The Primate Directive. Again, it's a 5-issue miniseries published between December of 2014 and April of 2015. Issue 1 has a cover price tag of $3.99. It's written by Scott and David Tipton. The art is by Rachel Stott. Color by Charlie Kirchhoff. Letters by Thomas B. Long. There's 3 different covers that came out. There's the primary cover by Rachel Stott, which shows a gorilla soldier in a close-up, and he has a gold Starfleet shirt clenched in his fist. The B cover, actually, I didn't write down who did the B cover. So
Juan Ortiz.
Juan Ortiz shows Captain Kirk transporting at the partially buried Statue of Liberty. And then the C cover, which I believe is by George Perez, has Kirk battling gorilla in a hand-to-hand combat while the crew of the Enterprise stands alongside Taylor facing off against a Klingon and some gorillas. So pretty cool that they got George Perez involved in this.
Which one do you have in your collection?
I have the prime cover.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait a minute. Actually, you know what? I have the, there was like a preview issue that Comic-Con, I think I had gotten a copy for you as well at New York Comic-Con. It's like a mini issue.
Yeah, I have that.
And that's, that has the prime cover on it. And I think the one I actually have in my collection is the Statue of Liberty one.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I have is the Statue of Liberty one. I can't remember when I bought it, if that was a choice or if that's just the one I wound up with in my pull box, but it's the one I like the best anyway. So yeah, I was very happy with that one. There was also a sketch cover and several retailer incentive covers as well, but I don't really care for any of those, to be honest. And I have to be honest, no disrespect to the dead. I do not care for the George Perez one. I'm not sure what it is with that.
It's a little too busy, to be honest. Yeah. And the posing doesn't look natural.
Yeah.
I figured we'd get to the covers. I agree with you. Well, the prime cover and the backup, the Statue of Liberty one, I'm kind of equal on both of those. I wouldn't really mind which one I have of those. The George Perez cover, I think the appeal of it is just the fact that it's George Perez, but yeah. I don't think it's his better work. I think it looks possibly a little rushed. And again, I think the figures don't really look like they're in a natural position. So, getting into the story, we open in Ape City, where General Marius, a guerrilla soldier, is being provided an automatic rifle that can fire 600 rounds a minute by a mysterious stranger who lets them know that there's, lets Marius know that there's more where that came from to serve their mutual benefit. Elsewhere, two very familiar looking Klingons, who turn out to be Sulu and Uhura, are infiltrating a Klingon communications post in order to obtain intel as to any plans to violate the Treaty of Organia. As they download the information, they are confronted and have to knock out a Klingon soldier. As they race from the building, they're surrounded but beamed onto the Enterprise. Sulu and Uhura meet with the triad of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Mr. Spock reviews the data and indicates that the Klingons have plans for expansion, but there is no evidence of them expanding in this universe. He's concluded that they have accessed other dimensional space. They also have coordinates where the Klingons are going to test their devices and set course for those coordinates. They arrive at the area and are promptly spotted by the Klingons, who power up their weapons system. The Enterprise goes to red alert. Kirk orders evasive maneuvers. There is an exchange of blasts with a bird of prey, and one takes damage to its nacelle as the other comes around and then breaks off into a portal. Kirk and Spock discuss the status as Starfleet authorizes the Enterprise to engage the Klingons and investigate the portal. McCoy warns them of the dangers of space tourism, but Spock believes that the portal is stable and that they would be able to return. In addition, their sensors indicate that at least four Klingon ships are headed to their location. Kirk orders a course to be set through the portal. Once they're through, they determine that they're in orbit around Earth in the year 3978, in a different universe. Spock is able to determine that there are signs that this Earth is at a point post a nuclear war. He sees only small villages and towns well outside of devastated metropolitan areas, and also sees indications that Klingon transporters have been in use in the area. Kirk orders Sulu to keep them in orbit around, on yellow alert status, and a landing party beams down, including Kirk, Spock, and two others. They see that a Klingon is having a conversation with two apes, and it turns out that the Klingon is Commander Kor, who we know from the Organian episode. Our story is to be continued. So we have, like, very, very little Planet of the Apes in this one. This is mostly a Star Trek issue.
Right.
And I did find that this series seems to be more focused on the Star Trek perspective than the ape, Planet of the Apes perspective. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but I wouldn't mind them having followed this up with another series that possibly showed it from the other side a little bit more.
Yeah, I noticed, Star Trek gets top billing, so to speak, you know, because the name of the series is Star Trek Planet of the Apes. So that kind of makes sense. But yeah, I agree with you. I don't know that it's necessarily a criticism, but I think that's also purposely or perhaps purposely why the story starts the way it does, because it starts with the apes. And without that sequence, you wouldn't actually get any apes until the last page. So I'm thinking that was kind of purposeful to, you know, give you a little bit of apes before it goes straight into pretty much just being a standard Star Trek adventure of sorts.
Yeah, I think that could be the purpose of having that initial scene. But the initial scene works well anyway, just the same. You know, because I don't know. I didn't see it as being a huge mystery that it's Kor.
But, no.
But I kind of like the way it's presented anyway.
I mean, I don't know if, you know, the identity of the individual Klingon might have been a bit of a mystery, but pretty much right away, you figure it's got to be Klingons, you know? Which... to me kind of begs the question, I would have loved to have seen that meeting, you know, so this scene that we open to is the Klingon handing the ape general the automatic rifle, but I'd like to rewind on that. I would like to actually see the meeting of the Klingon, you know, Klingon or Klingons, depending on how many there are, and the gorillas. What did that meeting look like? Because Klingon or not, you know, species aside, they look human. So essentially, these apes must have had an initial reaction of, oh my God, a talking human, you know, similar to how, you know, they react to Taylor in the original movie. So I kind of wish we had gotten that. I think that would have been really interesting because, again, you know, that, you know, just with the nature of the Planet of the Apes franchise, you know, they're always struck by, you know, talking humans. You know, that's always a big deal for them. So how did this meeting go?
Well, you know what? They're a little inconsistent on that because I just started doing a rewatch of the Planet of the Apes TV series. And that's going to be a very slow rewatch because I only watch a little bit at a time. But there's multiple talking humans in that.
Right.
And, you know, so there's some inconsistency to you know, when humans can and can't speak. The Tim Burton version, which I like to try and wipe from my memory when I can. But that one has, you know, multiple talking humans. So, you know, there is, again, some inconsistency on that. But I think the... you know, the version we know from the classic five episodes, anytime in the, well, let's go to the original two episodes because those are the two that take place in the future on the ape planet or on Earth as dominated by the apes. And they are always stunned by humans who can talk. In fact, you know, a lot of times they didn't even believe it that, you know, they thought it was some sort of trick. So yeah, I think, you know, there is an inconsistency definitely. And there would be some interest to see, you know, how this developed. Now, the fact that the Klingon is shown in shadows, maybe General Marius is only seeing him that way also and can't even tell that it's a, you know, a non-primate.
That's a good thought. That is true. But then at the end, though, I mean, is Core... I mean, it looks like they're face to face in that meeting at that, you know, at that point. So at that point, he must realize that he's humanoid, you know?
Yeah. So either there would be the moment of shock when they first met each other or the moment of shock when he came out of the shadows.
Right.
And we miss out on that moment.
Yeah. The whole idea with something like this is, you know, to get to the crossover, you know, to get to the melding of both Trek and apes, you know, and whatever that's going to look like. But that aside, does this feel just a little bit rushed to you, or do you think it flows the way it needs to get to where it ends?
I think I thought it flowed the way it needs to. I think if they had spent too much more time on the setup, it would have started to kind of get plotting a little bit. I think that would have bogged it down. I mean, they do give, you know, reasonable explanations for how this is all developing and how the crossover comes to pass. And I appreciate that. And, you know, we've talked of late. I know Dave and I had a conversation recently, and I think you and I did when we did the Iceman Human Torch thing, about how somehow sometimes on team-up issues they seem to get a little lazy on how the two parties or groups that really should have no connection to each other manage to combine. Here, the fact that the Klingons are branching out into otherworldly areas at least gives it a viable explanation. As far as why they'd want to do this, I'm not really sure. I don't know what benefit they get from conquering ape world in the future in a different universe. I'm not sure exactly how they're going to mine from that. But that would be, you know, then we'd be getting into Klingon politics, which might also be a little much.
Yeah, that's so full disclosure, while I really enjoy this series, it's been a while since I've read it, and I remembered very little of this very first issue. So reading it again and kind of poring over it, you know, for sake of talking about it, you know, I was just kind of struck anew by some things. And I like the characterization for the most part. I don't know. Something was kind of bugging me in the back of my mind of like, okay, they've got to get the Star Trek guys to the Planet of the Apes. What does that look like? You know, what's the mechanism for that? And so some of that, I thought, while it felt kind of Star Trek, it also, there were certain things that were bugging me a little bit. So for one, the, you know, as we get to the Star Trek part of it, you know, with Sulu and Uhura being on this covert mission, I don't know. I mean, did we really see a lot? I mean, I know Kirk and Spock were often doing this sort of thing, but do we ever really see the other characters doing this sort of thing?
No, but it does make sense that they would. You know, especially when you factor in that it really, from a military point of view, it doesn't make sense that Kirk and Spock would be going on these
right,
things.
Right.
So that makes sense to me. I was struck by this little covert mission in two respects. First of all, in Star Trek VI, we learned that Uhura really doesn't speak Klingon very well.
Yes.
So
yes.
So that you know, that we have a contradiction there. But also, I kept thinking of what's the episode when they want to steal the cloaking device from the Romulans? And they turn Kirk into a Romulan. And I always thought it was one of the silliest moments ever when Scotty comes over and, yeah, the Enterprise incident. When Scotty comes over and he can't even tell for sure if it's Kirk.
Right.
I always thought that was like one of the silliest moments that they ever did.
Right.
So in that regard, I look at the two of them and I think, boy, they don't look Klingon.
well,
you know, all they did was give, you know, they basically, changed their outfits, gave him a little goatee, and made their eyebrows go higher.
At the risk of sounding racist, and I don't want to sound racist, and I don't mean this to sound racist, but in the original Star Trek, especially the earliest episodes, especially the one with the Organians in Kor, the makeup job that they did for the Klingons did make them look vaguely Asian. At least I always thought so. And so, you know, having Sulu be part of this mission, to me, it's kind of logical because he sort of fits the mold, if you know what I mean, you know, with these, you know, the modifications with the facial hair and everything. He looks much more Klingon than she does.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we ever really saw a dark, you know, I mean, basically a black Klingon, do we? Well, I mean, later on, of course, you know, we got Worf and everything, but I mean, at this time,
I don't know. I'm trying to remember in that first episode, I don't think they did, but in the later episodes, like, something of the Dove. I can't even think.
Oh, Day of the Dove.
Day of the Dove. It seemed like the makeup was almost to put this dark skin
right.
color on them to almost make them look like people of color.
Right.
So, you know, in that respect, I would imagine they went there. Again, and, you know, yeah, we don't want to make it sound like it's a racism thing, because eventually they did establish that there were darker Klingons and there were lighter Klingons,
right.
just like humans.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's fine. And then I guess this would be consistent with that. Just not consistent with the actual original series representation of them.
I almost wonder if they could have gotten away with doing a different era of Trek, because it would have, while I like that it's classic Trek, and I know why they did it, because classic Trek and Planet of the Apes are, you know, were contemporaries, and that's talked about, you know, in the text piece at the back, kind of giving the backstory of this whole thing. And I get that. And I like that. I think that's really cool that essentially you're getting the 1968-ish version of Star Trek. And of course, you know, original Apes being 68. So I like that. However, I can't help but wonder if the story might have been better served with having the crunchy Klingons as opposed to the smooth Klingons, you know, because they are very, I mean, they're essentially just humans in makeup, Whereas the crunchy Klingons, you know, the Worf style Klingons, you know, they've got they're clearly alien. You know, they've got the turtle heads and that whole thing. That could have been cool, because then right away the apes know, you know, they're dealing with something completely different. They're not dealing with, you know, humans in makeup or humanoids. They're dealing with alien creatures. And I don't know, it's just something to think about anyway, or something I thought about during, you know, the course of reading this.
Right. No, it makes sense, but I think there's some inconsistency in the Star Trek lore as to the Klingons and why they looked the way they did in the original series, which I thought, you know, I kind of always thought that they were better off just saying, you know, that's just the limitations of makeup at the time and that they really are all the same. But they have done some episodes and different stories where they tried to explain that there was some sort of, you know, messing around with their DNA and that's why they looked the way they did in the original series, as opposed to the traditional Klingon look of every other series.
Right. So they did eventually kind of sort of straighten that whole thing out with Enterprise, but yeah, it still gets pretty convoluted and everything with the whole story. But I like what they did with that.
So from that we go to the meeting in the, I guess, in the war room, which I think is pretty cool, just because, you know, clearly the Tipton brothers were trying to recreate the dynamic of Spock and McCoy giving Kirk different alternatives, and that, you know, he would have to kind of, you know, basically the angel and devil on his shoulders, except, you know, both with good intentions, and that he would have to decide based upon their advice as to which way he was going to go. And I think they kind of played with that, and I thought they did it in a logical way. You know, McCoy was looking at it more emotionally. Spock was looking at it very stoically, and Kirk made a decision.
I always like trying to figure out when these things are supposed to be taking place. And the only real clue that I caught was that Kirk references the Halkins, which was from the Mirror Mirror episode. Because it's when Spock talks about, you know, that basically the Klingons are going into another universe. And Kirk says something, you know, like our experience with the Halkins. So this is clearly taking place after that, which means I believe that's a second season episode, if I remember right.
Yes.
So it's clearly taking place after the second season, which it would have to anyway, because, you know, Chekhov's involved. But I just thought that was kind of cool. But, it, you know, so far I've not been able to pin it down to exactly like when exactly is this happening, type of thing, or, you know, where's, you know, like what episodes does it fall between, type of thing. Which, I mean, you don't necessarily need to do, but it's just kind of interesting to try to figure out, you know, generally where it's taking place in the timeline. I did have a question for you. I was always under the impression that both the torpedoes and the phasers on the Klingon battleships fired from, you know, that the head of the ship, whatever you want to call it, you know, essentially the, you know, from the front of the ship. But here it shows the phaser firing from basically the warp nacelle. Is that right?
I can't tell you definitively, but I do think I've seen that.
Okay. I thought it was kind of cool. I just don't, I can't recall ever. I know they do that on the, like on the Bird of Prey, but these are battle cruisers. And I could not remember ever having seen that before. I mean, clearly that little mouth looking thing on the front of the battle cruiser, that's the torpedo tube, you know, the front, the forward torpedo tube. But I was always under the impression that the phasers fired from somewhere up there as well, or there may be one up there as well, you know, in addition to the one on the nacelle. But here, whenever they shoot, it's always from the nacelle, because there's another shot a little bit later on where the Enterprise is basically surrounded and outgunned, where a ship is shooting from both of the nacelles at the Enterprise.
Right. You would think from a design point of view that they wouldn't limit themselves to having to face their target in order to hit it, that they'd be able to turn and, you know, I mean, they do target their, you know, whatever they're shooting at, they aim at it. But I don't think, I'm not thinking in my mind that they have to move the entire ship in order to target something. I'm thinking, you know, there's some flexibility, and I don't think the nacelle itself would be flexible that way.
So right.
It would have to be some sort of attachment or something.
Yeah. It'd have to, I don't know about the Klingon ships, but like with the Enterprise, you know, the Enterprise has several different phaser arrays all around, you know, the main dish. Cause we see that in Star Trek II when the Enterprise goes into evasive maneuvers from the Reliant and is basically trying to get the hell out of the way. It turns broadside, but it continues to fire phasers that shoot from the side of the ship. And then, of course,
and you would think if you're trying to do some sort of evasive maneuver and you're trying to leave the area, that you'd be able to shoot behind you.
Well, yeah, they both have aft torpedoes, because in Star Trek the Motion Picture, we see the Klingon battle cruiser as the V'ger energy bolt shooting at it. It fires aft torpedoes, but they have no effect. And of course, the Enterprise has aft torpedoes too. But I'm trying to remember if we ever see the Enterprise fire its aft torpedoes. I can't remember off the top of my head.
And can they fire phasers from behind? I don't know. I don't know the answer to these questions.
I don't
specifically ever remember seeing that.
I would think so, but yeah, off the top of my head, I can't. The only visual I can pull up in my mind of aft torpedoes is actually the Reliant shooting aft torpedoes as the Enterprise is chasing it in the nebula. Mm-hmm. But I know that the Enterprise has aft. You know what? I think the Enterprise has an aft phaser array on the engineering section, like maybe under like the docking, the shuttlecraft bay, I think. Shit, I used to know all this stuff, but it's been so long. That's the fun thing about diving back into this, though, is, you know, a chance to get back into Star Trek lore again, because yeah, I have been kind of out of the loop on the Star Trek thing for a while now, but I do love me my Star Trek. I don't know, it's one of these things I need to get back up to speed on. If I had a model, I used to have an Enterprise model, but I haven't had one in a long time. But I was always more familiar with the movie Enterprise than the TV show Enterprise anyway, which I think was more advanced as far as weaponry and all that. Because the one on the show, you're right, they pretty much only ever showed it like fire straight ahead. So they basically have to be aiming at, you know, pointing at whatever they wanted to hit, you know, dead on, you know, straight ahead. I don't know that they ever even mentioned aft torpedoes or anything on the show. I can't remember. I don't recall. But you would think that they would have them just for practical purposes, so they don't have to turn around every time. You know, if they're being chased by something, you don't have to turn around to fire at somebody. You would think they'd have aft weapons as well.
Yeah, no question.
When they're not back. I was going to say, when they're running away from the Romulan super weapon in, God, what's the name of that episode? The first one with the Romulans. I'm blanking on the name of the episode. I was going to say, when they're running away, don't they fire at that thing to blow it up? But come to think of it, they're running away backwards.
You're talking about Balance of Terror?
Balance of Terror. Yeah, when that thing fires the thing, they run away, but they're running away backwards so that they're still facing it.
Hmm.
So yeah, I don't know. Maybe on the show they didn't have the ability to fire behind them. I really can't remember.
Well, I think they didn't have the ability to have the special effects show that. But, right, but maybe, you know, right. I think from a theoretical point of view, You got to think that they could fire behind them.
You would think so.
I mean, it seems like extremely poor design if they can't.
Yeah, I believe. Okay, this I could be dead wrong, but this is what I'm thinking: is that TV show Enterprise, I'm almost positive had the ability to fire torpedoes behind itself. But I like your question of could they fire phasers behind them? I don't know that that edition Enterprise had that ability, but I'm pretty damn sure that the movie one did. But I don't know. Somebody out there is absolutely screaming at their podcast right now going, these dumbasses don't know their Star Trek. But yeah, like I say, it's one of these things I used to know. And I wonder if I still have my Mr. Scott's Guide to the Enterprise. I used to love that book. I don't know if I still have it. That would probably answer the question, but no, I don't.
If we find an answer, we'll present it in the next episode.
I do really dig the what would you call this? Like the reconnaissance gear, the different uniforms that they wear down to the planet. I think that this is unique to this book. I don't remember ever seeing this look before, but it's a damn cool look. I really like that.
I like that. And I get a kick out of the fact that, you know, they're wearing a vest, which I assume has got some sort of protection, almost like a bulletproof vest or something. But there's still braids on each one, and Kirk has the gold braids, Spock has the blue braids, and then the other two that you think are going to die have the red braids.
Right. And Spock's,
we don't know who they are.
I like that Spock's got a two. It's very, that last panel of the book is very City on the Edge of Forever to me. I really like that. With Spock with the toque and everything, that's really cool.
Yes, my friend here is obviously Chinese.
Right. Well, I like these outfits because, you know, they're covert. That's the word I was looking for. You know, they're covert outfits. They're very reminiscent to me of Star Trek V, which, you know, mentioning Star Trek V, that's why I'm trying to be forgiving of that scene in the beginning with Sulu and Uhura, because that's actually one of my favorite parts of Star Trek V. You know, the film is when they stage their attack on Paradise City. I really like that. Kirk going in with the troops type of thing, and you know, they've got covert wear, and you know, they're on, you know, a mission. I really like that. You didn't really ever see that, especially not in the movie. I think that's the only time in the movies they do anything like that, and I thought that was really cool. And that's essentially what they're doing here. Although, again, you know, classic Star Trek, you got to question the wisdom of it being both the captain and the first officer and then just a couple of security goons, you know, going down. It's like, would you really risk both of them? But that's what makes Kirk Kirk, I guess.
Yeah. And they truly don't know what to expect on this planet.
Right.
They, you know, their information is that it's post-nuclear Holocaust, but that's it. That's all they have, you know, so you don't know if these people are mutated, if they have weaponry. You know, you don't know exactly what's going on. So you would think the command crew would be off limits from an away mission. But that isn't good storytelling. You know, it may be more realistic, but it's not, you know, it's not as exciting. I guess Star Trek could have had something where, you know, the captain wasn't one of your main characters. The captain is more in the background when everything's going on, and the crew members are your main characters, and then you know you're fine following them down, but you want your main characters to be the ones you're following.
Right. I like. And then, go ahead.
I was going to say the reaction when they see the apes is interesting because they've seen enough at this point that they're not going to be in total disbelief of what they're seeing, but they are going to be shocked by it. So I think there's a good, you know, Kirk's reaction is a good combination of the two. And then the look that Spock is giving him of what the heck is going on here. I think it's perfect.
I love the look on Kirk's face when he's just going, apes. He's just got this look like, what? I love it.
So he's like shocked by it, but he has seen enough in his life that he's not, you know, he's not going to say, oh, you know, I'm dreaming.
I love the moment where they come through the, whatever the barrier, you know, the tunnel essentially into Ape's universe. And it's almost like a recreation or like a nod to Miri, because Miri starts much the same way with them. You know, they're running all these scans only for somebody to look up at the view screen and go, Earth, you know. But nobody actually mentions that. And I thought, okay, that would have been nice to get, you know, maybe have Kirk say, Mr. Spock, is this Miri's world? You know, something like that. But there's, you know, there's no reference to it. But it is essentially, you know, kind of the same thing happening again. But maybe they didn't want to draw attention to that they've are, you know, they've all already had something like, because they ran across what? A couple of Earths in the series, right? Didn't they?
Did they acknowledge that they were Earths, though?
The Earth and Miri, yes. Yeah. They do.
Because I think they, you know, they encountered a lot of Earth-like planets, you know, like, say, a piece of the action.
Right.
Or, you know, trying to think of patterns of force. But those are not Earth. They are right. Just similar planets.
I could be wrong about there being, you know, multiple Earths, but I know in Miri specifically that is Earth, because somebody actually, you know, because they're, you know, Spock's running all the scans and he's describing the planet, and then somebody looks up at the view. I think it's Uhura, looks up at the view screen and just says it, Earth, and then you see it, you know, and it looks very much, you know, if you watch the original print, it looks very much like a globe that somebody just like took an eraser to all the names, you know, of the countries, you know, but it is the Earth. And I suspect that was done, because then when they actually beam down to Mayberry, you know, it gives an explanation for why isn't this an alien planet? Why is this just basically, you know, Mayberry all messed up? And it's because it was an alternate Earth where same type of thing. You know, there had been a Holocaust of some sort that destroyed the planet and only left, you know, the freaky children behind type of thing. But yeah, in that episode, it is specifically Earth. But there's something tickling my brain that there's at least one other episode where they run across an alternate Earth, but I can't remember if they actually call it the Earth, but maybe I'm just misremembering, because there's not just, you know, a head full of these episodes, but there's, you know, all the comics I've read and the books, and it all gets kind of muddled upstairs after a time.
Yeah, you know the feeling.
But you know, as excellent as this starts out, I really like the art. I really like the setup. You know, everything's going, you know, in a positive direction. The single best part of the whole issue, you know, when I read it originally and even now rereading it, is when you flip the page from the to be continued and you see the teaser image for the next issue, and it's Taylor and Kirk together at the Statue of Liberty. That's awesome. I remember being so, I was like, oh, hell yeah.
I was just going to bring that exact thing up, because reading through this one the first time, not this time, because I did recall enough of what goes on, but reading through this the first time, I started wondering to myself, okay, it's Star Trek Planet of the Apes, but are they going to have the Planet of the Apes characters that I'm familiar with? Because up to this point, the only character we get is General Marius, who I don't believe ever appeared in any form before this.
Right.
So, you know, this could have just been an alternate story that wasn't going to involve Cornelia, Zira, Zaius, Taylor. And I wouldn't have minded if they even worked Brent in at some point, but, you know, I don't want to be too greedy.
That's a good point, because I can't remember now whether that was known going into this series. I mean, clearly, you know, it's going to be Star Trek and Planet of the Apes, but I don't remember if we knew going into this whether or not we would be getting, as you say, the Apes characters that we know, because Boom had already, was it Boom that was doing Ape? Yeah, Boom had been doing an Apes series that I was picking up. Either just before this or concurrent with this, I can't remember, but that series took place considerably before Taylor's time, because the humans could still speak and everything. That was a really good series, by the way. So, you know, there was the possibility that this, okay, yes, the, you know, the Star Trek crew is going to go to the Planet of the Apes, but it could be any point in the timeline. And we, you know, so we might be just getting talking apes, but not necessarily any of them that we know. But yeah, seeing this image, you're right away, you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. And then, you know, the stakes just got raised type of thing. And of course the, George Perez alternate cover does have a Taylor,
and that is yes. But I honestly never saw the George Perez cover until I was getting ready to record with you today.
Oh, okay.
That's the first time I saw it, was when I looked up online for cover images.
I gotcha. Yeah, I no longer can recall whether we knew that going in or not, that you know, Taylor was going to show up. And I'm trying to remember who else does show up, but I don't know that we want to spoil any of that anyway. I'm having fun just kind of covering this issue to issue and revealing things as they come as they come along.
I can tell you, I did not know that Taylor was going to be in it. I wanted him to be in it, but I didn't know he was going to.
Right.
And I remember thinking, you know, anticipating, and we'll, I guess we can talk about this a little bit because it's not spoiling the next issue. It's more just the anticipation of the next issue. But I remember thinking to myself that Kirk and Taylor will be an interesting combination because they are definitely two alphas.
And, right.
You know, is either of them going to let the other one lead?
I think that's the great thing about this teaser image, is that not only is it both characters, but just the way it's staged, got me excited, because not only were they, you know, okay, they're both going to have screen time together, but wouldn't it be cool if, like, they're adversaries? And that's kind of the image you're left with here. You know, the impression you're left with from this image is, you know, because you've got Kirk almost looking like defeated or cowed. And then you've got Taylor kind of standing over him, you know, scowling down. He's holding his rifle and everything. And it does give an impression of, you know, an adversarial confrontation. So I like that. That was a great teaser. Like, oh God, they're going to meet, but they're going to fight, you know, or, you know, something to that effect. So I thought that was really cool. And yeah, it definitely had me jazzed for the next issue.
Yeah. Same here. So
yeah, that's about all I got on this. I loved it then and I love it now. I think it's exciting. None of my criticisms that, you know, were harsh. I do think it moves a little fast, but I also think it needs to move a little fast, because essentially you want to get to the good stuff. You know, you don't want to spend too long, but because of that need to just get to a good spot, you know, to set the whole thing up and have you excited for where this is going to go, it does feel a bit rushed and a bit contrived, I feel, you know, in all fairness. It all, you know, I think you started to ask before, you know, or said before about, okay, this is an interesting premise of the Klingons doing this, but why? What could they possibly be getting out of the deal that would be worth all this effort, you know, going to a nuclear destroyed primitive Earth, you know, controlled by apes? And I hope that question is answered, because I cannot remember. I don't remember what the hell they think that they're gaining from this.
I mean, and I don't want to spoil ahead, because, you know, we're trying to take this an issue at a time, but I don't think they do ever give us an explanation for why they're doing it, other than, you know, just the Klingons like to conquer.
Okay.
And they're being limited by the Organian Treaty in our universe that they're not able to. So therefore they're branching out to other universes because they can still conquer that way. But again, other than the fact that they like to conquer, I'm not sure what else they get out of this.
You know, there was always a big deal made in Star Trek when the Klingons would do things, you know, that were seemingly against the treaty or threatening the treaty or, you know, incursions into Federation space and everything. But doesn't this little covert mission at the beginning of the story, you know, I mean, they're sneaking into Klingon space. They assault a Klingon officer. And I think it looks like they kill the guy, but maybe they just, you know, knock him out or stun him or whatever. But then they are clearly caught and they run away. So isn't all of this threatening war from the Federation side? I mean, aren't they just as guilty?
Yes. I mean, I think the way I understand the politics of this, you know, there's a neutral zone and neither one of them is supposed to go into the neutral zone. But then on one side of the neutral zone is the Federation space. And on the other side is the Klingon space, and they aren't supposed to wander into each other's space.
Right.
You know, you're not supposed to even go into the neutral zone. So therefore you would never meet up because that's a buffer in between the two areas. So if that's the case, then how would they even get to the point where you could go into their planet and have it be an acceptable thing?
Right.
I question it. You know, I question the logistics of it.
I mean, they are clearly, even if the Klingons don't realize that it's Federation officers, if they're just, you know, hey, these are a couple of spies or these are a couple of people that, you know, are in an area they're not supposed to be. The alarm is sounded. We see Sulu and Uhura beam up to the ship, and then Kirk just orders them to warp the hell out of there. But I mean, the ship's not invisible. It's not using a cloaking device. So somebody's got to be, hey, that was a Federation starship that just zipped out of our area. I mean, you would think that this would cause all kinds of problems, but it's just kind of swept under the rug. Like, oh, well, you know, we got away with it. So I'm not sure it's that easy.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think some of this stuff, you have to just kind of just let it go. Because right. you're not going to come up with an acceptable explanation for it.
Right.
Unless, you know what, if somebody does, somebody's listening to this and saying, no, you guys are missing such and such point, please let us know. I'd be interested in hearing. And in fact, I think that's a good point for me to mention. I've recently re-accessed our backtothebins@gmail.com mailbox. I've gone in there and I've cleaned out all the spam, and there's a few emails in there. I'm not going to read any of them today, but there's a few that have been sitting around forever that I will get to. And in the meanwhile, if you have any comments for us, that is a place where you can send them. In the past, what we've asked is that you actually, in the subject line, put the words "not spam," because that makes it easier for us to pick out what is and isn't deletable.
Yes.
But if, you know, if you put in "not spam" and then what you're actually going to talk about in the subject line, and then, you know, go on. If we will either try to address your emails if you bring up a point, or possibly read your emails, or, you know, respond to you directly, whatever. But don't think they're being ignored under any circumstances.
Right. Yeah, we'll have to do I'd like to just do an outright email episode, and that way kind of send the message that, hey, we're back with the email thing. Because I do miss doing that, and I like that interactivity with our listeners. I like them to know that, you know, we want to hear from them. We care to hear from them. We care about, you know, their opinion, that sort of thing. And I like the information that they bring. A lot of times they fill in the gaps, and I could definitely use some gap filling on my Star Trek knowledge for this one here. I can't believe the stuff I've forgotten that I used to really be invested in. But
and once again, for the purpose of that, the purposes of that, it's backtothebins@gmail.com.
Yep.
Cool. So I think we should rate this issue, though.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, we didn't get to that. I'm going to go with, I feel equally on the primary cover and the B cover. Again, I never even saw the third George Perez cover until recently, so I'm leaving that one out. But the two, the one of the ape holding what appears to be Kirk's tunic, and the one of Kirk in front of the Statue of Liberty, I feel equally on both of them. I think they are both pretty much A images. I think they're both excellent. So I'm just going to give them a blanket A for that. The interior art, I think it's pretty solid. It's got that thin line look, and almost, I'm trying to think of who it's reminiscent of in my mind, and I'm coming up blank. But it's not that photorealistic look at all, but it doesn't feel like they're taking stock images and then just transferring them to a comic book image. It looks like original artwork done with the character models in mind, and I think it's pretty solid. I think the storytelling in it is good. I think the panel layouts are dynamic. I'm going to say an A minus. It's not quite an A plus or even an A, but it's really good. I'm very happy with the artwork, so I don't want A minus to sound like I'm giving them a negative grade, but it's really good. And the story, I think I differ from you to some extent, Scott, because I think they gave us plenty of background. I would have liked to have seen that first meeting with the apes and the Klingons. I think you came up with a good point there. But as far as setting up the Enterprise being in the Planet of the Apes universe and they're coming down to the planet, I think one full issue is spending enough time giving setup, and we want to get to the meat of the story and the actual meeting up of these different universes. So I don't really want them to give me more than they gave me. So I'm going to say with the space they had, they did a pretty good job with it. And I'm going to say an A minus on that as well. And I'm going to give the book an A minus. I think it's really good.
I think we're pretty close to each other. Like you, I don't care for the George Perez cover at all, but yeah, I'm just going to grade on the other two covers. Now, the one that I actually own is the one of Kirk beaming in at the Statue of Liberty. Now, normally, something that looks basically Photoshopped like this, I would be like, this is the laziest cover in the world, and give it a very low grade. But you know what? It works so effectively. It's just a great image of, you know, classic TOS Kirk. Taken, it looks like it's just taken right out of an episode, beaming in to this sad, dilapidated, broken Statue of Liberty. I mean, it's just an incredibly effective cover. That, and then the ape cover, you know, the ape general holding Kirk's, you know, torn tunic. It's very reminiscent to me of that Doomsday poster where Doomsday is holding Superman's tattered cape with his bone claws coming through it and everything. It's very similar type of image. And yeah, I think they're both fantastic. Yeah. Total A's on both of them. Interior art, I really like a lot. It's stylized. Sometimes it's a little too computery for me, or, you know, that computer color process or whatever. Maybe a little too bright, but I like the body language of the characters, because as you said, you know, nothing appears directly Photoshopped or just ripped off from episodes or whatever. However, everybody's body language, especially in the bridge scenes, is dead on. The way Kirk sits in his chair, the way he turns in his chair to speak to Uhura, the way she turns to speak to him. When the ship rocks, everybody's, you know, doing the thing, you know, like just out of the episodes. And I really like the body language. There's a great shot of Kirk, you know, in contemplation with his, you know, his hand up to his face, you know, Uhura with her hand up to her ear. I mean, just a lot of classic images and classic body language, but none of it just feels like, oh, they just copied this out of one of the shows type of thing. Everything feels very organic and natural, as if this just is the characters we're so familiar with on another adventure. And I really like that. Bonus points for the covert outfits that, again, I think are original to this story. So far as I know, I think they're really sharp, and that's pretty ballsy to invent something new, in a Star Trek story like this, but it really works well. I think it's very cool. And I love, you know, the whole wrap up to the thing. So, you know, art wise, I'll say an A on the art. I really like it. Really, I think, you know, if the coloring in certain aspects, especially like the ape stuff, was a little more muted, a little darker, I think that would help it a bit. But otherwise, yeah, I think the art was really solid in this, and the story, yeah, overall, I really enjoyed the story. You know, any criticisms that I said, you know, are very mild. You know, I didn't have like some major issue with any of it. And even though, as you pointed out, you know, I had the same note about Uhura. It's funny that she totally forgets how to speak Klingon by Star Trek VI. I think that makes her seem kind of stupid. So I'll forgive it that while it might contradict later continuity, I think it fits better here. And I think it makes her seem intelligent and everything the way she should as a communications officer. And, you know, as a covert operative here, that she speaks fluent Klingon. I just think that serves her character better than an idiot fumbling with books in Star Trek VI. As much as I like that movie, I've never really liked that scene. So I'll totally forgive it. So yeah, overall grade for the story, I'm going to say an A-, just because, yeah, it's a little contrived, but I understand they have to get them to where they're getting them. So, you know, there has to be a mechanism. I just thought the mechanism was a little clunky, but overall grade for the whole thing, I'm with you. I think I'll say an A-. I think it's really solid. It's off to a good start, and I was excited for where it goes back then, and I'm excited to reread it now. So yeah, it's good stuff. Solid issue.
Yeah, I agree totally. So we're going to get to issue 2 in the not too distant future. I couldn't tell you exactly when. I would say it'll be a lot quicker than that. But you know, we got to see how our schedules allow. That's always the deciding factor. And then, you know, just to pull the curtain back a little bit, I think, you know, we each have our, at least I have, my little pet projects that I do when it's just me and one other person. So, like, this will be our pet project for now when it's just you and I, when Dave and Bill aren't available. When it's just me and Bill, usually we'll do an Avengers spotlight. When it's just me and Dave, a lot of times we're going to do a Commandy episode. So, you know, we do have our pet projects, but a lot of times it's going to be 3 or 4 of us, and I look forward to those times very, very much. So I'm not going to put those on the back burner in order to do this. So we'll get to the next one as soon as we can. But well, thank you for listening, and let us know what you think. Now you have an email address to send it to. It.
I want to hear from the listeners. I want to know what crossovers for Star Trek crossing over to something, and also Planet of the Apes crossing over into something, what crossovers haven't they done that you would really like to see with these properties? And then when we get to the end of this coverage, Paul and I will give our own if we've got any, because there's one big one I'd really like to see Apes crossover with, but I want to hear from the listeners and see what they think.
I haven't really given that any thought, so. Now that you mention it, I'll have to try and think of what I would like to see. I think this one, honestly, this is the one. If I had, you know, if they had said to me, we're going to do one crossover and one crossover only, which one do you want? It would be Star Trek Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
So I got that. Now I wouldn't mind at all if the Tipton Brothers would give us a sequel to this.
Yeah.
I'd be very happy with that, but I'm not anticipating it after 10 years. So.
Well, I think it could be interesting. You know, have it be, I don't necessarily want it to be the newer Star Trek and the new Apes movies, but maybe like movie era Star Trek, you know, original crew, you know, Kirk, you know, the Shatner crew and all, you know, original movies era Star Trek with maybe like the new Ape timeline or something like that. Because the way this one ends, I don't know that there's really a sequel in there, you know, but I definitely would like to see another Star Trek Apes crossover of some kind. But yeah,
sure. All right, but in the meanwhile, thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.